individuals that are looking for housing at this time. And so for those that are looking and that we're here today, I hope that everyone knows that their voices were heard today.
What are the next steps?
Well, it's our hope that Minister Robertson will hear the message and be able to respond. We're looking for some emergency funding right now, at least to get us over the hump. I think that the reality is this is a program that is done significant help with government. I need you to know that, you know, the reality is there's people in wheelchairs that are stuck in hospital, and the reason they're in the hospital isn't because they need to be there. They have nowhere to go to next. We have people in extended care facilities, but we have people in seniors' home taking up a bed that could go to seniors. You know, they do not need to be in seniors' homes, you know, and so the Right Fit program has done an amazing job. They have navigators that work with both housing providers and wheelchair users to match them together. There's actually wheelchair units before us, before we came into existence. Wheelchair units were going to able-bodied people because housing providers weren't able to find wheelchair users to be able to use them. We made that connection now, and 9 years of that connection, it can't be dropped now.
Next, we spoke with Elaine Boyd, the executive director of Disability Alliance BC.
It feels pretty disappointing, actually. That's like the least I could say about that, particularly as constituency offices are meant to be open to the public. They're meant to be a pathway for the public to connect to their MP as part of the democratic process. I feel like that whole process has been completely shut down for us. As soon as they saw that there were a group of wheelchair users here to rally to save the Right Fit program, which we think we have a pretty good cause and a pretty good reason to be here, and we're a nonviolent group. We just wanted to make sure that Minister Robertson knows that we're here, that we want to speak with him, that we want an answer, and ultimately we want accessible housing to be taken seriously. And considering that our program is the only one of its kind in Canada, we think that would be such a shame if it no longer existed. So we're trying so hard to keep it alive.
Yeah, many of those who attended today are people that have directly benefited from the Right Fit program. How's it felt knowing that, like, you know, even if there wasn't a response today, there was still this showing of people here dedicated to supporting this program?
It's been really heartening over the past month, really, since we found out that our funding would be cut. So we found out our funding would be cut in mid-March, and since then there has been such an outpouring of people in the community, clients, staff members from a variety of other nonprofits, other nonprofits and community members writing in letters of support, calling for Mr. Robertson to save the Right Fit program. That has been incredibly heartening, and I think people really recognize how this program serves a very specific and critical service that doesn't exist anywhere else. So I think you would only really need to look at all of the advocacy efforts that's been happening so far to see how important this program is. What I have come to know over the past several years of doing this direct service work is how critical it is to educate the public, particularly those who aren't disabled, about how important accessible housing is, and recognizing that for wheelchair users who are in non-accessible housing, that equates to a type of homelessness. We call it hidden homelessness because they're not able to enter or leave their home without assistance. They're not able to cook a meal without assistance. They're not able to have a shower without assistance. Can you imagine living your life not independently where you could if you were in accessible housing? That doesn't seem a decent or dignified life to me, and everyone deserves that. Every single person deserves a decent and dignified life. And what I found is that advocacy surrounding this is so incredibly important. So I really just call upon anyone. You probably know someone who uses a wheelchair in your life. It's quite prevalent. And you should speak with them and really understand what barriers exist for them in the built environment and call for change, because we can't only rely on disability organizations such as Disability Alliance BC to make these advocacy points. We really need the full community to back us and recognize the dignity of people with disabilities.
Once again, you were just listening to Paul Gauthier, the Executive Director of the Individualized Funding Resource Center, and Elaine Boyd, the Executive Director of Disability Alliance BC, at a rally that they spearheaded to address a loss of funding for the Right Fit program, which is Canada's only program that matches wheelchair users with accessible housing. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcouver FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio today is Pablo Vimas, as he does every week, from Embark Sustainability. It's week 18. We're getting pretty deep into the season. Well, I mean, I guess the gardening season's just starting, but it's deep into the year.
Yes, indeed. We are week 18 since we started the year, and week 5. Yeah. Since we had the last frost. So, yeah, we are just... our garden is planted with most of the cold crops, and the weather is turning nice, warm, long days. Now, 5:30, we have sunrise till 8 o'clock. So we are seeing the season coming. And, yeah, we are... I think most of our gardeners out there, they are just busy in the garden. The warm... As mentioned, the air is warming up, and we have lots of insects. So we can see the dandelions here in campus are all over the place. They are flowering. Yeah. Lots of bumblebees around, lots of honeybees. Butterflies are showing up. The white cabbage butterfly is going around checking where to lay their eggs. So it's fantastic to see all this life coming. Mm-hmm. And then, because the days are getting longer, the rain has stopped. It's very important for us to start looking into watering.
Right.
So that watering becomes very important, because now most of our fruit trees are in flower. Mm-hmm. And after the pollination, the fruits start to settle. Yeah. And we need to continue now a good scheduling watering. So we want to have nice, beautiful apples or plums, if you have that. But in our case, we just planted peas. Mm-hmm. So when the peas flower as well, we need to be consistent with watering.
Right.
So we gardeners have a rule, watering frequently, but water deeply, deep into the ground. So the deep the water, so we call that deep watering, so add lots of water so the water seeps to the lower layers of the soil. Yeah. And the plant will just follow the water, and creating a deep root system and a strong root system that if we forget to water one or two days, there is water and at the bottom of the or your garden bed or in the deep layers of your soil.
The deeper the roots go, the more likely the plant is to be able to find water.
Correct. Yeah.
Given a bit of an interruption.
Yes. Yeah. So there is nice soil at the bottom with lots of nutrients, air and water. Yeah. The plants put the roots very deep. And that is an advantage for us because, as I mentioned, we can't forget 1 week of watering, but we know that there's a strong root system in there that will take water from the very bottom of the soil, and they won't have any stress. Yeah. That means that we need to take our time when we are watering. Mm-hmm. For instance, 5 minutes for a 4x4 garden bed is quite a short time, I will say, yeah. because I usually take more than that, making sure that really the water gets to the lower layers. But also it depends on the type of soil. So previously we've been talking about if your soil is sandy, you will need to water more often, because the water evaporates, the water mm-hmm. doesn't retain. If it's a clay soil, you will have to have more space between watering, because the water will be collected by the retained by the clay particles. So you need to bit by bit start looking how often I have to water. Daily watering I don't advise, because we need to consider the water conservation. Mm-hmm. So you cannot come and water. And the other thing is, if you water every day, all the nutrients from your soil is just being washed away.
Right.
So it's not good. So here in campus, we water twice a week during the summer, which usually is before the weekend on Friday and the next week on Tuesday. So with this nice kind of... And if rains, which we very much always welcome a good rain, we wait at least 48 hours after the last rain to consider in watering or not.
Right.
Yeah. So it's important to keep the watering schedule once you plant half flowers. So we want that the fruit are the, for instance, peas. We want that the peas to grow nice and strong and juicy.
And they require a lot of water to fill them out.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the plant requires lots of water to fill all those fruits. Yeah. Because at the moment, we are already thinking, oh, the weather is turning warm. Shall we bring our tomatoes out? Shall we bring our cucumbers out? Once they flower, we need to keep a watering system very nice and consistent. Yeah. So here in Embark, we have our garden beds are self-watering system, which means we have a container with 25 liters of water in there, and has a system that the water by capillarity gets out of the container into the soil. Yeah. And so we don't have to worry out now to water quite frequently, but we still monitor how wet the soil is. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, how we do, we dig in an area that is not planted. Yeah. We dig at least 15 centimeters deep pocket.
Yeah.
And from the bottom, we take a bit of soil and we squeeze in our hand. If we water comes between our fingers, there is too much water.
Yeah.
If we squeeze and nothing comes out and we open our hand, you will see a clump of soil nice retained, so it's quite moist.
Yeah.
But if that clump of soil crumbles, means that there is no water at all. So it's like, so that is a field test that you can do in your garden. For pots, last week we were talking about container gardening. For pots is a bit more difficult because now you cannot go and dig, but you might need to put your finger at least as deeper as you can and see and feel how moist is the soil.
Right. So when you're watering, you know, you can get nozzles for hoses and stuff that have all sorts of settings.
Yeah.
What's the one that you recommend is going to work best for our garden?
Oh, yeah. So that's a good question. We gardeners tend to get gadgets the more settings that it has. But at the end of the day, we end up just using one, a shower head.
Yeah.
A shower head. And so one setting is more than enough. So a watering one with a shower head, that will be enough. And the rule is you water the soil, not the plants. The water has to go into the soil because the soil retains the water where the plants take from. We try to avoid moist in the leaves. So the leaves, and particularly when it is in summer, there is high humidity because we water the leaves, high temperature, a nice environment for bacteria and pests to grow. So we don't want that. So water always the soil. So that is, and Sometimes when you have a nozzle with different settings, the jet set is the other thing. That's when we are tired and we just want to use the jet set from water in the extreme corner of the garden, you know, from where you are standing. But at the end of the day, it's better to walk around with your garden hose and just water. I like here we have garden hose. We tend not to use watering tanks because they are, water is heavy to carry.
Yeah.
And after two or three trips, you are tired. For instance, our garden beds 4x4 will require at least six watering cans of four liters each.
Yeah, well, you're saying it could take 5 minutes with the hose, so how many trips is that with a can?
So many trips. Just installing a hose. And nowadays, we have those beautiful hoses, the expandable ones, very light, to just connect it, and it fills, expands, you water. When you are done, it compacts, and you can store in a bucket, so it's like, or a basket. So it's quite easy now. Before, we had these hoses made of PVC, unruly, they crack, they kink. And then you had to fix the hose. But nowadays, I think we have the advantage of the expandable hose, which is very useful for any size of garden.
Excellent. Any other issues or when it comes to watering?
With watering, just remember watering the soil, not the leaves. Watering deep and infrequently, so not every day. And try to use the shower head rather than a spray or a jet.
Yeah.
The other thing is that when you are watering, always touch your plants. Mm-hmm. Move your plants, and you can see whether how the plants are doing at the back of the leaves. Particularly now we have plants are nice, are juicy, are green, and aphids, they start showing up. And so as you touch your plants while you're watering, you have as well the opportunity to see if there is any insects showing up in there. And then you can start taking the right measurements for stopping the expansion of that pest.
Excellent. All excellent tips for watering and keeping on top of keeping your plants healthy. And
Yes.
And importantly, as you mentioned, the fruits and the growing strong so that you really get the harvest you're looking for.
Correct. So if you're always looking for a nice, juicy, plummy tomato, so and watering is very important to obtain those produce.
Excellent.
Lovely.
Thank you so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. Tell us how folks can find out more about Embark.
So if you would like to hear more about what Embark does, please visit our website at embarksustainability.org. At the moment, we are calling to anyone in campus that is interested in doing gardening or learning or developing their gardening skills. We start our summer cohort on May the 7th, I think, and we go for 7 weeks, so we go until June the 18th. Yeah. So we have that nice time to develop our gardening skills. So again, all that information is in our website as well in our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thank you, Pablo Vimas. We'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Peter Arich is here to talk more about art.
Well,
it's 3 weeks in a row. We're getting very arty.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's Stephen kind of. what was more direct than the CIA? Well, it's kind of.
So we're again sort of visiting the idea of the abstract expressionism and.
It wasn't quite funded by the CIA, but it was more delicate than that. However, one thing that was more obvious was a 1954 animated cartoon made over in England, based on George Orwell's Animal Farm. Mm-hmm. Now, this is rather direct because the 1954 animated film Animal Farm was secretly funded and produced by the CIA as Cold War anti-communist propaganda. And there was a producer that was sort of like, was American producer Louis D. Rochemont acting as an intermediary to hide CIA involvement? So I think what it was there was a British animated company making shorts, and they just got the money to make a feature, and they wouldn't have otherwise had made it. Now this is a lot more of a direct thing. The other thing it says, the film was released in 1994 but failed to make an immediate profit. The other thing is that this is full animation, because what started limited animation was the Mr. Magoo cartoons in the 1950s, and it was a studio, UPA, they were ex-Disney people, and they started in the late 40s doing more of a limited animation, but experimental, and that led to the Huckleberry Hound and so on later on.
So what do you mean by limited animation?
Well, you don't have any drawings.
So is that sort of the thing where you might have a scene where, for the most part, the scene is static, but for instance, the character's mouth is moving.
Yeah, so that's about
their arm is like one element is moving at certain points, and then sometimes there's more movement, but sometimes there's that sort of it's not fully motion and panning scenes and stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah, and so this was fully animated, so it was a bit of a costly production, and that's a more of a direct involvement with the CIA, and as I said, they had a kind of a shadow producer that really wasn't a producer. Now, I went to an event Friday at the Paul Kyle's gallery. Yeah. Paul Kyle's the son of Joseph Kyle, who is a pretty good abstract expressionist, not funded by the CIA.
Important to note that.
Now, I brought up, there was somebody, he had a book, he said, Canada in the 1960s, the golden period, whatever. But he sort of contradicted himself. Now, this person was a lawyer in the 60s, and he's 93. And at the age of 70, he retired from being a lawyer. So he's mainly a lawyer. I think he may have written a little bit on art or whatever, but I don't. He was there, and Paul was happy to have him there. So I just sort of said, trying to be as unoffensive as possible, I said, there has been talk about CIA involvement in abstract expressionism. Could you just tell me how much you know of this? So he didn't say much. But he said, now then, this is Clement Greenberg. Now, what I found out about Clement Greenberg was sort of important here. Now, he was part... Oh, I can't find it here. It doesn't matter. There's other things to say about him. But he was part of that group which was funded by the CIA in the early 1950s, Americans for Cultural Freedom. And I don't think he was aware of any CIA funding. They had government funding, but he didn't know the CIA funding.
Right, you know, through...
Yeah, but this...
Different programs and you know...
In fact, what was said on Friday, he's going to say, well, if anybody was part of this CIA thing, it was him. Now, this guy was interested, because I had a look, I saw a video by him. He was a promoter of Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock died in 1956. I saw a late 70s an interview with Clarence Greenberg. He said by the late 50s, abstract expressionism had created the worst art in Western civilization. And he said something else that was interesting. He said in 1962, there was a stock market decline. And this transited to abstract expressionistic prices, because a lot of these people that had bought the abstract expressionism had investments in the stock market.
Right.
And they had sort of panicked in 1962 and were selling off works. And actually, he
said, like selling off the artworks.
Yeah, selling off the artworks in 62. It rebounded later, of course, because Jackson Pollock's go for $50 million or whatever. But during his lifetime, Jackson Pollock said, why is nobody buying this? I rolled around in a farm in Long Island. I don't know. But anyway, so Andy Warhol's first major exhibition was in Los Angeles in 1962. Now, the collectors sort of went to pop art, a sort of a panic thing, or they're thinking, oh, we're going to get this at a lower price. So that's kind of what happened here, which is interesting. So he, Clarence Greenberg, lived from 1909 to 1994. But what's interesting, I think he gave up. He thought that the art world and artists had lost a sense of aesthetics completely. And he thought this since the late 50s. And Keith Haring, I was trying to think, you remember, you know about Keith Haring, don't
you? Yeah, he was, I don't know what you call it, but it's very broad, graphical sort of art style.
Well, I tried to get...
Figures and stuff, bold, really bold lines and bold colors.
He died after Keith Haring. And Greenberg. So I was trying to get what he thought about him. And what I got from the internet, I said, oh, he wouldn't have liked him, even though he didn't make any comment about it. One thing that he was against, commercialization in art. In fact, he wrote in 1939 a article about kitsch. Kitsch on both sides of the political spectrum. Kitsch from a capitalist perspective and kitsch from the Soviet pictures of Stalin and all this.
Right.
So he was. He said that. But the true avant-garde artist escapes kitsch on both angles.
Right.
Because as I was telling you in previous weeks, the futurists wanted Mussolini to accept their artwork, and he said, "No, we're just gonna have pictures of me." And in the Soviet Union, there was constructionism, which was an avant-garde movement in Russia and later. And no, we're just going to have pictures of me, Stalin.
And maybe a few bold workers.
Yes, a bold worker who, except if you're at the you McCrane, we're going to keep all your wheat and you're going to starve.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to finish off here quickly. In 1933, there was a Mexican muralist who was going to do something at Rockefeller Center. And actually, Nelson Rockefeller was 25, you know, youngish in a way, but he was overseeing this, and he was okay with it, except when because the guy was going from a bit of a Marxist bent. He had a picture of Lenin, and actually
who was the artist?
Oh, it's here somewhere. It was Rivera.
Oh, okay.
A Mexican muralist.
Yeah.
And actually, whatever Nelson Rockefeller's initial feeling, his opinion changed after an article appeared in May 3rd of 1939 in the New York Road Telegram, right, under the headline, Rivera paints scenes of communist activity and John D. Jr. Foote's bill. Oh, I get you. That would have been his father or something. And then Nelson Rockefeller's. And he said, no, we can't have any more of this. So here's the guy who's in charge of the Museum of Modern Art in 1942. So I see it more that the Museum of Modern Art was pushing abstract expressionism, which had its dealings with the CIA and so forth. And so we got a book from 1995 I haven't read in 31 years. I bought it 30 years ago.
It's about time.
It's about time. It's about 800 pages here. But I'm going to be next week going to be talking about this book.
Excellent. Thank you for tuning in to today's edition of Speak Up. Speak Up will be on again tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. sharp with Danny Nezvadarani behind the chair here. And again on Thursday with Jesse Wentzloff in the chair. Lots more great local and international news and reports and interviews and lots of interesting stuff. So tune in for that. Stay tuned now for Democracy Now!, which is coming up in about 10 seconds. Wandering Rhythms up at noon. Typically Tuesdays at 3, and lots more great programming coming up this evening.